Hello, and welcome to another episode of Electrify This, a podcast focused on electrification as a primary pathway to decarbonize and revitalize our economy. Each month, I connect with experts to explore the policy and market issues underpinning the shift to electrified transportation, buildings, and industry. I'm your host, Sarah Baldwin, Senior Director of Electrification with Energy Innovation. Today's episode, An Electrifying Year, a 2023 Retrospective. Welcome, listeners, to the last podcast of Season 3. It's going to be a really special show as we have three amazing guests to give us an electrifying roundup of the year 2023, which was action-packed for the clean energy transition and electrification, especially here in the U.S. From the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law to state actions on EV policies and building electrification, as well as the myriad federal regulatory activities on climate and clean energy, 2023 was no sleeper. So today, to round out the year, we're going to have some fun as we reflect, opine, and look ahead to 2024, and for some good old-fashioned prognostication. But first, I have a few announcements. First, I want to hear from you guys. I am so appreciative of my listeners. You guys are a global audience, and we don't get a chance to do a two-way conversation. So we are launching a survey that I'm inviting you to take. It'll take less than 5 minutes of your time, but we want to hear from you. Give us your ideas, your thoughts, your suggestions, and be a part of shaping this show. Check out the link to this survey in the show notes or visit our webpage, energyinnovation.org/electrify this. And also, we have a new email for you to reach out to us directly. It's electrifythis@energyinnovation.org. So drop us a note. I'd love to hear from you. Second, I have a podcast that I've been listening to and I'm really excited about, and I think you should check it out. It's called With Great Power. It's a podcast from GridX. And as we talk about all the time on this show, the transition to clean energy technologies like solar, wind, electric vehicles, heat pumps, and batteries is really already underway. And there are so many people working to build a customer-centric, zero-carbon, and more reliable electric grid to support these technologies. With Great Power is a podcast about the people who are building the future grid today. Every other week, host Brad Langley talks with the executives, engineers, technicians, and big thinkers who are harnessing the forces reshaping the electric grid. I'd recommend their episode with Apoorv Bhargava, CEO and co-founder of WeaveGrid. They discuss how the company is future-proofing the grid for millions more EVs. So take a listen to With Great Power on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and be sure to tell them I sent you. So now, let's start this show. As I said, this is a super special episode because I'm joined today by three esteemed guests, including two longtime leaders in the podcast space that you may recognize, and a leader in the U.S. Department of Energy's new Office of State and Community Programs, and they are all just doing amazing things right now. So first, we have Stephen Lacey. He's the co-founder and executive editor of Latitude Media, which is an integrated news, research, and events company focused on the new frontiers of clean energy and climate technology. Stephen's also a veteran business journalist, editor, and audio producer who's been covering the energy transition for nearly two decades. He's the host of the Carbon Copy podcast and news show, the former editor-in-chief of Green Tech Media, and the founding producer and host of the Energy Gang podcast. It is such a pleasure to have you here, Stephen Lacey. Thank you for joining us, and it's really an honor to have the founding father of Clean Energy Podcasts on the show.
So thrilled to be here. What a great lineup, and appreciate you inviting me on.
Next, we have Julia Piper, who is the Vice President of Public Affairs at GoodLeap, which is a leading financial technology company focused on accelerating the deployment of sustainable home energy solutions. Julia is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a selection committee member for the Zayed Sustainability Prize. And she's also the host and creator of Political Climate, a podcast presented by Canary Media and the USC Schwarzenegger Institute. Julia has spent a decade working as a climate and energy reporter, serving as a senior editor for Green Tech Media, a reporter for E&E News, and a published author in numerous prestigious news outlets, among many other accolades. So welcome, Julia. It is so great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for the kind introduction. I was telling you all before we hit record, I recently had a baby. So we'll see if my brain even works at all on this podcast. But it's nice to be here with you. And Stephen, my GTM colleague, it's funny going back to our WeWork days in Washington, D.C., where we were writing all these stories. And here we are, flash forward. It's a different world and so many exciting things on the horizon. Thanks in large part to everything our next guest is working on.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations and thanks for carving out some time to be with us, even with the new baby taking up a lot of time. And last but certainly not least, we have Dr. Henry McCoy Jr., who's the director of the Office of State and Community Energy Programs for the U.S. Department of Energy. Dr. McCoy is a seasoned professional in business, community and economic development, policy, government, finance, energy, philanthropy, and the academic worlds. Prior to joining the U.S. Department of Energy, he served on the faculty at North Carolina Central University School of Business, where he led entrepreneurship programs with an additional appointments at Duke and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Harvard. He's a former banking executive and a former assistant secretary to the North Carolina Department of Commerce and has many other accolades. I shall not go on given our time, but thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. McCoy.
Thank you, Sarah. Wonderful to be here with Julia and Stephen, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Same here. Well, let's get started. There's much to cover. So, Stephen, I'm going to start with you. It's been 2 years since you left the Energy Gang podcast. You moved on from Green Tech Media, and you've kept yourself pretty busy since then. So tell us more a little bit about what you've been up to and what you're working on these days.
Yeah, we're just making lots of podcasts. So as you said, I'm host of The Carbon Copy, which is like a hybrid narrative news and roundtable show that's covering all the tech and business trends at the forefront of the clean energy market. And we've got a couple other shows that we make as well. And we've since expanded into news research and events covering, you know, the cutting edge areas of climate tech. So that includes like frontier trends in renewables and how distributed solar is being turned more into virtual power plants, how the digital layer of controlling renewables is evolving, how artificial intelligence is playing into that. And then also some of these large industrial sectors that are emerging thanks to both government support and private sector investment in carbon removal, green hydrogen, and long duration storage. And so I came into this market in 2006, seeing the real banking dollars start to emerge in wind and solar, and then later battery storage. And a lot of the trends that I saw in the mid-2000s, we're starting to see in some of those frontier sectors. So we're just trying to track how it's all evolving and make that information as practical and useful for people who are actually building these projects, growing these companies, and raising this money and working with the government to grow the industry. So it's a busy time for all of us.
It is, and just amazing that you're keeping track of so many spaces and have such a finger on the pulse with respect to this clean energy transition. So excited to dig in more and find out what you've been seeing over the past year. So I'm going to pivot to Julia here. You also have recently left the podcast Political Climate that I mentioned. You said you had a baby, so that's probably taken up most of your time. But what have you been up to since then? And where are you working these days?
Yeah, so Political Climate, as you mentioned, is a podcast we ran for 3 years with support from the Schwarzenegger Institute and Canary Media. Ran for 5 years. See, brain not working. My co-hosts were Brandon Hurlbut and Shane Skelton. And the whole point there was to have a Democrat and Republican talk about climate policy and politics. We never entertained denialism. It was about getting in the trenches of what was happening on Capitol Hill at the state level in the regulatory settings to figure out how decisions were getting made with different perspectives from how to address incentives or free market initiatives and really hash out the details. So we had some amazing guests on over those 5 years. I really loved doing it. It was such a joy. We got to go to Vienna with Arnold Schwarzenegger himself and go to one of his climate summits there. That was a real highlight. But we decided to pause it at the end of, I guess, last year, right as the IRA was really, you know, kicking in. We were seeing that it had passed. It was signed into law. And in my day job now at GoodLeap, we were just really busy. We kind of realized that there was a lot we could talk about, but also a lot we had to do. Shane and Brandon and I all work on policy now. So that's my current role, as you mentioned at the outset, with GoodLeap. And GoodLeap, for those who don't know, is currently the leading financier of residential solar in the United States. And we're also one of the fastest in what we call sustainable home improvement. So that's heat pumps, geothermal, batteries, insulation, roofing, windows, doors, anything in the home that lowers the carbon footprint, even drought-resistant landscaping, we help finance. And we finance it because, as you probably know, a lot of people can't afford the upfront cost of a lot of clean energies and sustainable solutions, even though they save money over time. So that's where financing comes in, specifically in our case, loans. So the customer owns the product and usually adds value to their home in addition to that. So I was drawn in kind of similar to what Stephen said about the money, where the money was moving. You know, at a macro scale, we need to mobilize, I think it was $50 trillion by 2050, according to JP Morgan, to reach net zero emissions by 2050. A new study just came out from Deloitte, I think, that puts it even higher at $5 to $7 trillion per year between now and 2050. And we're not even mobilizing $2 trillion. You know, we're seeing clean energy investments increase all the time, but we're way off the mark for where we need to go. So I looked at GoodLeap, which is a fintech layer that connects the largest financial institutions with the contractors who roll out trucks and get on roofs and in your garages every day, with the customer as well, all through a technology layer so they can get that financing and make that purchase in a really seamless manner. Because banks aren't doing that directly. Contractors can't do it on their own. So that's where GoodLeap comes in. And I was sort of drawn to that element. And I went from talking about policy on political climate to actually working on policy today. So we're trying to make the dent in that 42% of emissions that come from decisions made in the home. And that's what I'm working on. I'm excited to talk about more today.
Well, that sounds like a really exciting transition for you and a really good fit for your experience and expertise. You're where the rubber hits the road, or maybe where the insulation hits the walls. I'm not sure.
I like that.
That's great. That's very exciting. And as you said, so important. The finance piece, I think, has been a bit neglected at that residential individual kitchen table layer for many years. You know, there's a lot of focus on the big utility stuff, and the finance world there is all over that now, but it's that you know, the individuals making these decisions that really do need that financing. So excited to hear more about what GoodLeap does and what you've been working on over the year. Next, I'm going to ask Dr. McCoy a little bit to tell us a little bit more about your fascinating career. You are clearly a man who wears many hats and has a lot of deep experience across many fields. So tell us a bit more about your background and what led you to work for the Department of Energy.
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, the career I've had is has culminated in this work here. And so as you read off my bio, I've had a, you know, very touch points in areas such as banking and finances where I started my career. And early in my career, I really, I ultimately worked with developers who were doing large projects for the bank that I was working at. And they had lines of credit up to about $300 million. And this is in the mid-90s, just as banks were starting to think about merging and acquiring each other. And so I kept pushing the bank to think about how do we make sure that the dollars that are going into the projects that we're putting out through these developers really focus on a couple things. One is, I mean, obviously we want these investments and loans to come back to us from a sustainability standpoint. But beyond that, you know, how do these dollars go into communities, in particular communities that historically have been left behind, and really make an impact in those communities? The additional component of that is, how do we make sure that these dollars are not contributing to global warming, not contributing to climate change, but actually helping to reverse those? And so I pushed that a lot early in my career. And it was, you know, as a young banker, it was like, well, just do your job, Henry. As I was able to rise up the ranks and get some levels of position, I was able to push the bank to do more of that work. However, I felt like that there was still so much to do. And so after about 10 years, I left banking and moved into my own investment space and really worked with entrepreneurs who were trying to be on the cutting edge of areas such as clean tech and solar and energy and those things, but also blending that again with the notion of creating a bridge to communities that have historically been left behind. You know, one thing led to another. I helped set up what ultimately became the Green Business Fund in North Carolina as President Obama and the governor then, Lieutenant Governor Beverly Perdue, were elected. I got pulled into the political arena a bit. And anyway, you know, all that's to say is that for me, it's really about, I always tell people I don't like to think without doing, and I don't like to do without thinking. And so my work ultimately looks at how do we, you know, stand in the balcony and kind of look over and think about the overarching landscape and the systems that are in place. But then, you know, how do we also get on the dance floor and make the investments that it takes to make this become a reality. And so I try to culminate all that into the work, you know, try to build a team that can do that, try to set a vision and a North Star that gets us to a point that, you know, as Julia said, I mean, you know, $50 trillion or $5 trillion. I mean, that's a lot of money. And so the resources that we have really are at the, you know, just the tip of the spear of that, and hopefully a way to drive the private sector to put more dollars in as we, as a government, takes a bit of risk off the table. And so I get the great honor every day of waking up and having an opportunity to go out and try to figure out how to make the world a better place and how to make investments that can hopefully over the long term really create some significant impact.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful day job and full-time job for sure. I know how much is happening now at the DOE with federal funds flowing and so many grant programs, and you guys are really at the helm of so many components of the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act, the Infrastructure Act, and so really applaud all the work you and your team and the many branches of DOE are undertaking at the moment.
Thank you. People like to call us the Department of Everything. So
that is actually pretty accurate at this point. Yeah, I like that. Well, awesome. So this conversation today, as we discussed in the intro, is really to focus on the year that we just had. It was a really big year in terms of everything, really. Clean energy, electrification, investments, decarbonization, the rollout of so many programs. A bit dizzying for those of us who are in the space, and probably a little esoteric for those who maybe aren't paying close attention. So hopefully we can help people understand really what this year meant in terms of our global clean energy transition, especially here in the U.S. So I'm going to start with a question for each of you. Obviously, this podcast is focused on electrification. So I'm going to ask you to talk about, in the electrification space, whether it's transportation, buildings, or industry, what were your top highlights from 2023? And Stephen, I'm going to start with you.
There are so many stories to choose from. I had a little bit of a hard time with this one. But ultimately, I had to come back to the evolving and growing battery economy. And so, as you talk about on the show, like, you can't create an electrified economy without using batteries as a backbone. And there have been, as by many tallies, $100 billion in investments in new EV factories, battery factories, and factories for stationary storage, thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act. So a lot of that investment is coming into the United States. Just recently, the Treasury issued guidance on the EV tax credits, and there are big questions about how electric vehicle models in the U.S. are going to qualify for those tax credits. And it doesn't look like many or even any of them will at this point. So there's a lot of retooling of the supply chain that needs to happen in the United States in order to meet those guidelines. But there's a real imperative here, because China owns, you know, upwards of 90% of the supply chain in critical minerals processing and battery manufacturing and assembly and EV components. And under an industrial policy, a green industrial policy, there has been a historic effort to bring much of that investment back into the U.S., which will feed into one of the stories I want to talk about a little bit later around the geopolitics of this. But ultimately, this change in the battery economy is absolutely massive and feeds into very substantial, immediate conversations that countries are having on global trade and political relationships. So that battery economy piece really stood out to me as one of the most significant accelerators one of the stories that has accelerated the most in the last year.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the cool thing that I see happening is that there's this massive push to onshore EV battery manufacturing and the supply chain, as you mentioned, but there's also this big push to deploy utility scale batteries for the grid, and they're having a real complementary effect on the overall price and the economics of batteries, which even just a few years ago, we couldn't necessarily say we could see that downward trend, but we're seeing it more and more. But as you say, that pivot to the kind of what's next, and now we've got a different set of challenges on our hands, which is to bring more of these facilities to the U.S. quickly so that we don't lose years in the next decade as we need to deploy megawatt scale, gigawatt scale energy storage and lots of EVs. So I like that one. That's a good one. Julia, what about you? granted, I know you were paying very close attention to a little baby, so.
Yeah. No, still plenty of sprawling in the middle of the night.
Nice.
All good. Mine is actually in a similar vein. I went for industrial policy as well. Stephen was talking about $100 billion. This is on the order of $200 million, but it's the fact that President Biden used the Defense Production Act to spur manufacturing here in America of heat pumps and related technologies. So we actually just saw last month the Department of Energy announce a selection of 9 projects that will receive, it's actually around $170 million. And those manufacturers will boost electric heat pump manufacturing here in the U.S., as well as those key components at 15 sites in 13 states across the country. So it's a real, again, industrial policy move where we're seeing the United States step up, make more of the equipment that we want to see deployed to electrify everything across our societies. And I think it's just fascinating that they use that Defense Production Act mechanism, because that is really a tool for, in the moment of crisis, to accelerate and the use of funds. And so they have justified the use of it, which I think is really historic and precedent setting. Of course, there's some pushback from some on utilizing that kind of mechanism. But if you agree that that climate change is a crisis, indeed, that is the right mechanism to use. So I think it's precedent setting, even if the dollar amount's not in the billions, it's still in the hundred millions. We'll see maybe more manufacturers stepping up and make the kind of equipment that qualify for those rebates and tax credits that we want to utilize. So it takes that whole picture coming together. So that to me was a key piece. If I could offer one more, I would point people quickly to the Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities that just issued an order this week that was really interesting. It was on the future of gas, and it will radically transform, as I understand it, how gas utilities will operate in that state. They can't charge customers for new gas infrastructure if there are viable alternatives. It changes cost recovery, so you can't incentivize new gas customers, and it prohibits utilities using ratepayer money to promote natural gas, and they have to submit these compliance plans every 5 years. It effectively eliminates the gas utilities in this proceeding itself, which is kind of wild. It basically says you need to electrify or die, which is pretty incredible. And so, you know, there's some reporting on WBUR.org that folks can look to for more details, but I thought that was pretty significant here at the end of the year.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, there are so many headlines now hitting my news feed. I'm like, okay, this is clearly the final push before the end of the year. Make sure everything gets, wrap it up and put a bow on it. But yeah, that was a big, big one out of Massachusetts. And absolutely agree with you that the industrial policy piece and that connection to the Defense Production Act is pretty impressive in terms of what the country is saying to the world about our commitment to electrify and get off volatile fossil fuels from places that are not friendly. So thanks for both of those. Those are great. Dr. McCoy, how about yourself? I know you look at a lot of different facets of the clean energy transition in your work, but in any electrification highlights that came across your desk?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that I would highlight, and I think it goes back to, you know, some of the comments I made in the intro in terms of this idea of DOE being the Department of Everything. And to that point, the office that I lead, the Office of State Community Energy Programs, SCEP, and the things that we do, we have 28 different programs that comprise $16 billion of investments. And so I say the first thing that I think about when it relates to this notion of, hopefully taking a huge step in electrification is actually the standing up of this Office of State and Community Energy Programs, which, interestingly enough, we're a very, very new effort in DOE to really go into this place-based work that we have and to really try to touch communities in new and different ways. I used to joke when I went out and gave talks when people would ask me, come and, tell us about what you're working on. And I'd talk about it's $16 billion and how we're invested. And we always had these very high level, highbrow kind of titles for my talks. And I was like, well, at one point it just felt like the title of my talk should be, everywhere, everything all at once. Right. I mean, just simply that's how we were making investments. And so I think the first highlight for me is just, kind of at that balcony level is this notion of standing up the Office of State and Community Energy Programs, which I came into DOE in July of 2022, which, and I tell folks, we had $6 billion at that time between our annual funding and our some of the bipartisan infrastructure law. 3 weeks later, the Inflation Reduction Act passed toward the end of August, and all of a sudden we had $16 billion. And so certainly for us, it created an enormous shift in how we focused on the work. But even that, you know, into the summer and spring, summer and fall of 2022, we were getting the office stood up. And so we actually officially became an office at the end of November of 2022. So we just celebrated our 1 year anniversary. And so really, the work that we do within SCEP, as we're called, really touches all those points of electrification and the place base. So we got buildings, we're working with schools and nonprofits to electrify their buildings. We're working at the residence level to electrify homes, tied to things that we've been doing for a very long time around weatherization. We have other resources that's going out. So really, that first highlight is just being able to stand up an office that touches all those different points at a place-based strategy to get people really understanding and thinking about what does it mean to really electrify a community and how does that tie into job creation and opportunity and healthier environments and things of that nature. I say the second piece of that, now going down to the dance floor, is really looking at the Inflation Reduction Act, right, and what came about with that. As I mentioned, we got a bump of about $10 billion whenever the IRA passed in August of 2022. And we ultimately now manage the largest consumer-facing part of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is Inflation Reduction Act rebates. And that's whole home rebates to really electrify homes at a broad level and try to drive energy savings from that component. And then we also have the appliance side, which is looking at, you know, putting resources, putting appliances to the home to drive electrification from that standpoint. But we also have an additional component, which is our codes, where we're trying to incent with $1 billion states to adopt the latest, greatest codes as it relates to that work. And then in there, we have $225 million for tribes, all the tribes across the United States, the lower 48. And so really those are the two highlights for me in terms of thinking about where we are, because this is a long game, right? But we still have to hit the gas and accelerate this and try to get folks to buy into it. So on one level is being able to stand up the office, get it in place and say, okay, there's all these touch points for electrification. How do we invest in those? How do we buy down risk? How do we help incent the private sector to bring money in so this work is sustainable? And then secondly, you know, on the ground is really deploying these IRA rebates and codes funds really through our partners at the state level to get this work done. And so I think it is a very exciting time.
Yeah, 100%. We actually had a couple of your colleagues on a show earlier in the year to speak on the rebate programs that you've mentioned and the workforce programs, which are a big part of that, and tons of activity happening. And I'm really hopeful that the states are going to pick up the ball and run fast or faster to get these programs designed and implemented. And the near doubling of your budget, I'm sure, was no small thing at DOE to staff up and create the infrastructure to make sure these funds get out in an efficient and successful way. So kudos to all that, and love those too. I'm going to pivot to a related question, but this is more kind of the newsy headline of the year question. What was your biggest headline of the year, Stephen?
I might have a little bit of recency bias here, but one of the headlines that I saw really speaks to the challenge in the U.S. EV industry right now. And that is a story from Politico that just came out. And the headline is, Congress provided $7.5 billion for electric vehicle chargers, built so far, zero. And that headline might seem hyperbolic to people who are, I mean, it's true, but the question is, what is the accuracy behind that? So, they dig deeply into the slow nature of implementing many of these incentives to build out charger networks. And the government is still working with states on the standards for where these chargers are placed and how long they need to be up for. Their uptime is really important, how they process payments. This is all very reasonable stuff. And so we have yet to see any of these chargers built because many of the localities are still working through these standards and contractors are trying to figure them out. So this is obviously an immediate challenge because We have a lot of dollars sitting there waiting to be deployed for national EV infrastructure. And people who are thinking about EVs now or in the next year may be concerned about the lack of availability of EV charging in certain areas of the country. And so, yes, this is an issue, but ultimately what it tells me is that there's a lot of really considered thinking about how to make sure that these chargers are actually going to function properly. If you go out on social media, there's a lot of videos of people getting to chargers and showing that they don't work. And there are reliability problems with some of the way these chargers are maintained. And we want to make sure that there are really clear standards for how these chargers are built and maintained. And so I feel like implementing these a little bit slower and then having a reliable charger network is a much better outcome than getting them out very quickly and then having problems down the road. And then you just create a whole other set of problems for consumer perceptions that may actually last longer. So it's a very nuanced story. Most people believe that a lot of these chargers are really going to start to get deployed in mass numbers in 2024. It's certainly a challenge, but I think ultimately this is a challenge worth figuring out because these standards are incredibly critical for this charging network.
Yeah, that's a really important one. It definitely came across my radar several times over the last few months. I do think there is a bit of hand waving and, oh my gosh, the sky is falling that's happening, which, you know, tends to be the response when things actually are moving and changing. But I couldn't agree with you more. There are some challenges to work through. You know, I'm heartened by the fact that there is another new office, the Joint Office of Energy and Transportation, which is another novel concept for the federal government to actually join energy and transportation, spurred by the Infrastructure Act and these electric vehicle charging programs. And, they're working with the states hand in hand to figure out their transportation plans. Where are these going to go? What's the process? Anything that's built really, really fast probably isn't built really, really well in this day and age. So I think that you're absolutely right. Taking the time up front to get it right means we're going to have far fewer issues down the road, quite literally. great. Thanks so much, Stephen. What about you, Julia? What was your biggest electrification headline of the year?
Right. Well, yeah, it's going to get to EVs a little later, but I do think it's interesting to see headlines around demand dropping in the meantime for EVs. And we can talk about that more if we have time. But in the meantime, we got to keep the consumers, I think, excited about this technology as we build all this great infrastructure. But my story is actually a little bit of a wonky one, so bear with me. The headline I picked was from Canary Media. It's entitled Income-Based Electric Bills, the Newest Utility Fight in California. And the subhead is, a state law calling for utility bills to be based on household income could drive adoption of EVs and heat pumps or punish rooftop solar inefficiency. Now, this is a little wonky, so bear with me, but I want to bring some more color to this debate because I actually think it's really critical. How rates are set will, not only in California, but across the country, really set, I think, the landscape in which we can see consumers electrify. And I think it's so important to get it right. So while that subhead kind of laid out this tension, I think, you know, we're seeing different research on both sides of this active proceeding that will have a decision coming out in the new year. And so for context, what this California law does, it says that new fixed charges, so charges that you cannot avoid by saving energy or going solar, will be required for all Californians, so 40 plus million people, starting in the next couple of years, and they'll be based on income. As it's unfolded, what that actually means is that it'll be based on whether or not you're receiving utility rate assistance. So if you're not currently on a rate assistance program, what we call CARE and FARA here, everyone else will be on the highest fixed monthly charge. And so the debate is around what that fixed charge should be. How high should it be? For context, the national average across the country is currently $10 per month. So 10 bucks you pay no matter what, no matter how much energy you use. What we're contemplating here in California, that highest end in San Diego territory was over $120 per month. So a massive fixed fee that you would pay every month, no matter what, no matter how much energy you consumed by simply switching off the lights. And what this means for electrification is it's a lively debate of, hey, if you pay a fixed fee every month, wouldn't you consume as many electrons as you want? You'll get that EV, you'll get that heat pump because you're paying, say, $100 a month, no matter what. But I think the picture is actually a little more complicated because when you're using those electrons also matters, because here in California and in many states, there's that peak time issue. So if everyone's plugging in their EVs at those peak hours. That puts more strain on the grid that we're trying to shore up here. And so you can actually see electrification exacerbating the issue we're trying to address with fixed charges. Fixed charges meaning we can invest in the system. Utilities have a reliable income coming in from those charges, rather than having all of one's electricity bill be based on what are called variable charges. And those fluctuate with how much energy you use. So you, in the variable sense, you only pay for what you use. In a fixed charge world, you're paying a set amount no matter what. And so some people have argued, again, that that'll promote electrification with a higher fixed fee. You can, it's an all-you-can-eat buffet of electrons. But there's research from Clean Coalition and other utility experts that show the exact opposite, that the high fixed charges proposed here in California actually improve the economics of electrification only marginally at best. And for some customers, it will actually be more affordable to stick with gas. It'll be $40 to $400 cheaper to stick with gas for many customers. And that's because so many are in that bigger bucket of high income, what we're calling high income customers. That's just the way the cookie's crumbling around how they're going to organize this. So what that means is a single mother with one child living in an apartment, making $40,000 a year, she's considered high income in this scenario. Who would pay that highest fee? So even if we end up with around a $30 to $40 fixed charge per month, that will be one of the highest fixed charges in the country here in California. So this is a very active debate with lots of very smart people on both sides of it. I would just posit that California actually did some legwork already in creating what are called electrification rates, and they exist, and you go on them if you get solar today in California, you go on them if you get an EV, and they work the exact opposite of a fixed charge. Rather than a blunt instrument, these charges change based on time of day. So you're incentivized to plug in when there's abundance of clean, cheap power on the grid, say in the middle of the day, or when no one's using their power as much at night. So if we move to a world where there's a fixed charge you can't avoid, I fear we're actually going to exacerbate the issues we have with the grid, that particularly moderate and lower income customers who are still considered high income in this world, in this proceeding, could get dinged for actually using less energy and having to pay a charge no matter what. So I think we have to have this healthy debate around utility rates and how to get them right for the future electrification. And I think the rubber really hits the road on electrification is a lot of times at these wonky Public Utility Commission proceedings. And I think it'll set the tone going forward.
Yeah, regressive rate design is a big challenge for a lot of things. So thanks for flagging that for us. Stephen, were you going to jump in and say something?
Yeah, I was just going to agree with that and say that rate design is like the single most arcane yet fascinating and consequential piece of the energy transition and electrification broadly. And if you do it wrong, it can have really drastic consequences for customers and for the value of clean energy and electrification. So that's a good story.
Yeah, great one. And off my radar, so thanks for flagging. Dr. McCoy, how about you? Any electrification headlines that stood out to you?
Yeah, and in some ways, I think it ties into what, you know, both Stephen's headline and Julia's headline from that standpoint. So this article is actually from just about a week ago. A Wall Street Journal article written by Lisa Ward on November 29th with a headline is, "What will motivate more people to make their homes more energy efficient?" And so I think the article, you know, talked about how research is looking to figure out what are the certain kinds of financial incentives that are more effective than others to get people to electrify their homes. And so I think about, you know, Stephen's comment about, you know, this notion of how quickly things are moving, because obviously a lot of people have heard about the rebates and the question is, you know, always, well, you know, where are they, you know, when can I get my money and things of that nature. And so there's a rollout that, you know, as we're working with states to get them to draw down funds and move forward. And so there's a certain level of impatience around that. And certainly we understand why people are excited about this or want to move forward. Think about, you know, what Julia said in terms of, you know, how do you have the right rate structure to incent people to use the electrify their you know, kind of places of residence and to you know, use demand at certain time. And so this article really looks at this idea of, well, what are the right things between tax credits, between rebates that drive individuals to make decisions about adopting these technologies in their homes and moving forward. You know, we have a lot of conversations here at DOE about virtual power plants and about, you know, how do we, you make these connections. We also think about, you know, when incentives are tied to, for example, tax credits, but What about for populations that don't have tax liabilities? How do you make sure that they're going to be a part of this process as well? I think there's a lot of very interesting and really effective aspects of incentives that have been built into this legislation. You know, we have the direct pay model now that allows those without tax liability to actually get a direct investment from the government when they stand up a large project. And so this particular article really stood out to me because on one level, anytime any article comes out anywhere that talks about Inflation Reduction Act rebates, things like this, it certainly ends up on my desk because usually somebody's saying, hey, you know, where are they at and how are we moving forward? And so, you know, those things tend to kind of rise to the top of what gets sent to me. But this really is the key question, right? I mean, in terms of electrification, in terms of moving down this route, how do you get people to understand their value proposition in all of this? You know, when they electrify their home, you know, what is the benefit that they're going to get to being a part of this? And so I think that as we move forward, this is going to continue to be the key driving question in all of this, is what are the right incentives to balance? Because people have different you know, incentives for doing things. You know, as we've been going down this road and down this process, we have had you know, contractors and others that we work with to do research, say, okay, well, what are some of the kind of typical individuals that are making decisions about whether to adopt these rebates? And, you know, and these are not monolithic kind of populations, right? So even though we say, oh, well, these dollars are going to be for low to moderate income individuals, and that's 80% of area median income below, 80% to 150%, or for the whole home, it actually doesn't have an income cap, but it is, you know, it's a rebate versus a tax credit. But even so, there's still a whole lot of different opinions within that population of individuals, and you know, folks have different decision points about why they want to engage in this work. So anyway, that's the headline that really stood out to me and stands out to me.
Can I riff on what Dr. McCoy was saying really quickly? This consumer piece is so interesting to me because I do think that consumer perception of these technologies is shifting, because these are, like, if you look at heat pumps and you look at electric, you look at induction cooktops, like, they're just a better technology. And when you see that people use these technologies, they become evangelists, because it's like cooking or heating your home with an iPhone, right? And I saw this with my father, who was like a hardcore gas guy. There's no other way to cook than gas. And then he got an induction cooktop, and all he wants to do is talk about how great it is and cook for me. And then he just installed a bunch of heat pumps, and all Thanksgiving, he's wandering around the house, like, you know, just showing me how great they are and how each room is heated at a perfect temperature. And so I see this personally in my life, and I see it on social media, and I see it in the press, that these technologies in electrification are just better. They're improving. And so along with the incentives and how people figure this out, I think the consumer mindset is starting to shift. And that, to me, is a bellwether.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Although we have to note, they are still in some cases expensive. I wanted to electrify everything. I had Nate the House Whisperer, who we all know and love, or many of us do, come do my blower door test and everything. And in my 1,200 square foot house here in California, it was still going to cost upwards of $20,000 to retrofit my system to a fully electric heat pump. And this was with comfort settings and additional things. So bells and whistles. But especially in the retrofit case, when you're not talking new buildings, it can cost a pretty penny. And my current system, when I bought this house, was only a year old. So it's, you know, you got to catch people on that cycle of when they're making that purchase decision, or else you lock in for 15 plus years, that legacy gas one. So I both agree with everything Stephen says. It's what we work on every day. But I also am aware of the challenges. And I just had a contractor in my house actually servicing my system yesterday. And, you know, he said, you know, unless you have residential solar, he said it's really hard in California to save money with electric products today, which gets back to the rate design question. So anyway, I want to just also note the challenges ahead. I think we have to cheerlead these solutions, but be honest about where the pitfalls are, so consumers understand what they're getting. Because my biggest fear is they feel like they were sold a bill of goods and are not happy with their electric technology. And then we have more educating and catching up to do, where the answers are all there. We just need to present them correctly.
Well, just so you say, I mean, I'd agree more on that point. I mean, and we're very cognizant of the fact that what you don't want to do is to, as you say, sell a bill of goods that turns out not to be the right thing, right? So you don't want to tell everybody, oh, well, add this heat pump and your bill is going to automatically drop with no questions asked, right? I mean, you know, there's a lot of that goes into this from the educational point, and to your other point. I mean, we really see the resources that we have through the Inflation Reduction Act to try to be, again, that jump off point that figures out how do you make this work from an economic standpoint. Again, whether that ends up being virtual power plants or some kind of way by which you're doing, you know, this distributed energy aspect, or, you know, the EPA now has the solar for all, you know, the $7 billion that is going out, and community solar is a part of that. You know, how do all these things actually work together to drive that forward? With us in the Inflation Reduction Act, I mean, even to qualify for the dollars that we have, you know, someone has to go in and be able to do an assessment that shows that a household can get 20% savings from that. But again, even once you move forward for an implementation, you know, the proof is going to be in the pudding. So again, I think all these things are critical questions. We also know that, you know, depending on the age of the house, I mean, that has an impact on you know, how they respond to these technologies. And so, you know, this is not just an easy check the box. I mean, there's really a science behind this. And so that's why we really try to take this work extremely serious in terms of how we move forward and, you know, how do we impact the customer in the most beneficial and positive way.
Yeah, I agree with everyone and all the comments made. And I think it's a good transition and a segue to my next question, which is more kind of future looking. So we've had a big year, 2023. You guys have highlighted even like a small fraction of the overall trends from 2023. There's so much more that happened, and maybe, you know, we'll have to do a second show to dig in on some of these subtopics because they're all really important. But looking ahead to 2024, it's another big year. Clearly, there's a lot of work to do. So I want to know what's really top of mind for you. What's keeping you up at night, other than maybe a newborn baby? What's keeping you optimistic and hopeful? And Julia, I'll start with you this time.
So one of the things that's on my mind, you know, we've talked about the Inflation Reduction Act, is the lack of awareness. I think we all know very well what's in it. But if you actually look at some of the polling, the average voter, the average customer is still not aware of what the Inflation Reduction Act is. Even the contractor I mentioned who's in my house the other day, he knew all about like utility rebate programs. He had never heard of the IRA. And so we still have a lot of, I think, reality checking to do as to like how you get the dollars deployed and who's aware of what it is. And certainly if you're a political person working for the president, you want to make sure that credit's being given where it's due as well. So that's the other piece of all this, is the election is looming and will certainly affect the future of electrification policy at the federal level. So I think we have to do a lot more work of making people aware of the Inflation Reduction Act. There was a survey that SunPower, the solar developer, did that found the vast majority of Americans don't think they can afford solar and other electric products because they think they're too expensive, but they're also unaware of the incentives that are available to them, and specifically unaware of the IRA. So there's, again, this research that shows we have a lot of legwork to do. So that's one of the things that I think keeps me up, because it's so solvable, but we still have to like work really hard every day to make sure that these benefits are actually reaching folks and that they know they're there and make those purchasing decisions. The last thing I'll say on that, though, is I think reaching mainstream with IRA dollars is also a concern of mine. I know we have a lot of specialized programs that are designed to meet particularly customers who've been left behind in the energy transition, which is super important. But I've also seen the potential for this to become a niche kind of program where specialized startups are the ones deploying those dollars and not getting the mass manufacturers and the big contracting companies, the folks who people just find on Google and they're probably the first people they pick to replace their HVAC. If we don't make this mass market available, meaning the incentives are easy to access, not tons of paperwork, not super onerous, if we don't do that, I fear they'll become niche and we won't actually see that mass scale transition to electrification that we need. And that's all about the implementation of IRA. So those are the things I think about a lot going forward.
Agree on all of that for sure. If only there were podcasts voted to the topic that people could share with their friends and family to educate them. Hint, hint. Great. Dr. McCoy, how about you?
Yeah. So anybody who works for me and communicates with me know that you know, there's a lot of things that keeps me up at night when I'm sending emails. That, you know, that you're liable to get an email from me at any time in the night and morning, just when I do a lot of my work. But to your particular question, what really, really, really keeps me awake is tied somewhat to what Julia said, which is about the education component, particularly consumer protection, because with the hour rebates, and we think about 2024, so you asked about kind of what is 2024, you know, it's, for me, it's really like rebates, right? You know, how do we get these rebates out? How do we get them out effective? How do we drive this? Certainly the codes from IRA are important as well, because, you know, what the legislative kind of, you know, ground kind of landscape also drives, you know, what happens in the household, right? So as we try to get more and more states to adopt the latest, greatest codes, kind of a race to the top, as the secretary likes to say, it impacts all of this. But at the end of the day, I know that one of the huge, huge areas that we have to really be focused on is the educational aspect of this, so that individuals do have the right information. I mean, this is not only about, you know, how would this heat pump or how would this technology impact your bill or things of that nature, but also just to make sure that the individuals are not getting essentially swindled, right? I get letters all the time that I always tell people that, interesting enough, every letter that gets sent to the White House or the president or whomever actually gets answered sooner or later, because it may come down to me and say, well, look, somebody came to my house and they sold me solar panels and they said the government's going to give me my money back. Can you give me my money back? And we have to say, well, no, actually, that's not, that's not true. And so when you're talking about something like the appliance rebates, where some people know some things, some people have heard this, some people heard that. You know, that really is something that we have to really focus on, that fraud, that waste, that abuse, taking advantage of individuals who only know part of this. And, you know, one of the things that the article that I mentioned talked about was really the influence of the neighbors and neighbors have on each other, right? And so one of the things that we're really exploring is, how do we, you know, create in communities and environments that where folks are getting information and they're sharing information, and, you know, how do we protect the consumer and all this? And so 2024 for us at the Office of State and Community Energy Program is going to be about not only getting these rebates out, the drive electrification, as Julia said. I mean, it certainly is it's an election year. We know that. I work for the president, and we know that, you know, making sure that this is going to be in place for the long term is critically important. So those are things that, you know, I will spend a lot of time focused on in 2024.
Great. Well, it sounds like you'll get a couple days off and then you got to get right back into it after the holidays. So work cut out for you. Stephen, how about you? 2024, what's top of mind?
Well, I think what Julia and Dr. McCoy just outlined there is definitely center of mind for me, particularly the consumer protection piece. I mean, this industry is filled with some pretty enormous success stories, but also, as we've seen, waves of investment and government support. You know, you see consumers who are getting taken advantage of. And although it's a very, very small number relative to the amount of solar and battery installations and energy efficiency upgrades that we see, they can have an outsized impact in the industry. So that is definitely, as we think about scaling the industry in the wake of IRA funds, something that I am also, that is also top of mind and I'm also concerned about. But what really keeps me up at night is obviously just the enormity of climate change in a very real way. I mean, I certainly feel the anxieties of being behind in even achieving a 2-degree centigrade temperature stabilization. So there's a lot of anxieties that I have around, even with the growth of renewables and other clean energy technologies, the fact that we're so far behind. I will say, though, that what gives me hope is that we are seeing technology pathways that are starting to narrow some of the dire scenarios that we were considering even a few years ago. And that is because of the extraordinary improvements in costs and deployments of clean energy technologies, particularly in the power sector. And so if we look at what happened this year, I mean, we're going to install 400 gigawatts of solar this year, and 300 gigawatts of that is going to be in China. And we're going to be approaching like a terawatt of solar. And so we are seeing a very clear pathway to tripling renewables in the next 8 years or so. That's something that's been being discussed at COP this year, and it is something that can absolutely happen. That's one of the things that needs to happen, along with increased electrification, increased improvements in global efficiency of the global economy, and also investments in carbon removal and nuclear. We are starting to see some of the things that will keep us on a net zero pathway happening. So I got a lot of hope there. At the same time, though, we are going to see some of these other technologies that maybe are a bit more controversial, like direct air capture, like advanced nuclear. They need to scale too, and they need to scale very, very rapidly. And we are not nearly at the gigaton scale in carbon removal that we need to see. So all of these things need to happen together. Some of the pieces are happening. I'm very hopeful where we're seeing that acceleration, but I definitely have a lot of anxiety about the areas that we're lagging.
I'm surprised no one mentioned they're excited about the delivery of their Cybertruck from Tesla, which just came out 4 years late and looks like a tank. I don't know. But it's bulletproof on the plus side, I guess.
Is it though? Is it really?
It wasn't at the unveiling. That's true.
Those are all great. I'll add to the mix real quick. I have a lot of things that keep me up at night and a lot of things that keep me hopeful, but the one thing that I definitely am going to be keeping a closer eye on, and I think we should all be kind of aware of, is this big push to hydrogen as the do-it-all, be-all, end-all of our carbon-free future. And there are absolutely applications for green hydrogen to help us decarbonize some of the harder to decarbonize sectors of our economy, including in industry. But there are a lot of sectors of the economy that really don't make any sense for hydrogen. And we really should not spend the time, money, and resources, if we can avoid it, in trying to make the square peg fit in the round hole. So that's definitely something that keeps me up. The other thing related to that is just the sheer volume of additional clean energy and clean electricity that we will have to generate and build in order to meet the new load coming from electrolyzers, unless it's completely off-grid and paired with solar and storage and not trying to interconnect with the big grid. But even then, it's a very large volume that I think people are not fully accounting for in their hydrogen hype. So that's just one for me. Okay, we're going to round. Oh, sorry. Stephen, did you have something to say there?
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, we're obviously going to need a significant amount of green hydrogen to serve industrial applications. But I don't think people have truly grappled with the amount of additional renewable electrons we need to see to support this industry and the way people envision it. So I share that anxiety.
And, with that, I am hopeful that we are going to start to really figure out some pathways for the industrial sector as a whole to begin to contribute to this decarbonization future, because we've got a lot of work there to do. So, good job security for all of us. Okay, so we're going to pivot to something fun. And I'm a big fan of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And so we're going to model this final segment after that show and their quiz, their trivia quiz, their news headline trivia quiz that they do with their guests. And I'm going to ask each of you four questions. They will each be worth 1 point. And the winner has the coveted opportunity to return to the show and be a guest once again. So
wait, I don't get your voice on my voicemail.
I mean, if you want it, Stephen, I'm more than happy to do that for you. I think that's actually a great exchange. Let's talk, because I think your voice on my voicemail would be also fun. Okay, so
let's
I'm
do
gonna.
It.
Okay.
Does anyone listen to voicemails anymore?
I was just gonna say, yeah. I have like one friend from back in the day who leaves me voicemails, but nobody else.
I mean, I still have an answering machine. I don't know what you guys are talking about. Not really. Okay, so Dr. McCoy, I'm going to start with you, and we're going to do this in rapid fire sequence. So, if you have the answer, great, and if you don't know it, just say pass or I don't know, or come up with something clever, and we'll take a guess. Okay, and then if you get it right, I'll say yes, and if you get it wrong, I'll say sorry, not the right answer. So, are you ready, Dr. McCoy?
Yes, fire away.
Okay. This year, offshore wind sent electricity to the grid for the first time in U.S. history in which state?
I don't know. Pass.
All right. It was New York. In a report released this year, the International Energy Agency identified what as a key technology for decarbonization efforts to provide highly efficient non-fossil fuel residential heating?
The pit rock.
No, heat pumps. the United Auto Workers and which auto manufacturer announced a deal recently that would create 1,300 jobs at a new EV battery operation at its manufacturing plant in Belvidere, Illinois?
Was it Ford?
Close. Stellantis. And finally, according to Bloomberg and as reported by Canary Media, this clean energy technology has reached the tipping point for mass adoption in the U.S.
Heat pump.
Close. EVs. All right. So we have 0-4 for Dr. McCoy, but good effort there. Okay. Stephen, we'll go to you. Are you ready?
Yes. This is where I tell everybody I'm an authority in the news, but now I really get to prove it or not prove it.
All right.
I'm ready.
Great. How many EVs were sold in the U.S. in 2023 through November?
Oh, God. In 2023 through November, let's see, 300,000?
No, over a million the first time that we've cleared
a million.
Million
in a year? Oh, it was a million in a year. I thought we had a million on the roads. Right, okay, so it was we've hit the million mark. Ah, yes. I knew that. And I had the million number in my head as like the total number.
That's all right. Which state installed the most utility onshore wind capacity in 2023?
Onshore? Texas?
Yes. With 890 megawatts through September, we still are waiting for the last quarter's report. In a monumental climate trial this year in August of 2023, in which state did a judge rule in favor of a young environmental activist who said state agencies were violating their constitutional right to a clean and healthy environment by permitting fossil fuel development?
Montana.
Correct. And finally, according to the International Energy Agency in the U.S. in 2022, residential heat pumps made up 53% of heating system sales, exceeding the sales of what for the first time?
I'm going to either say electric resistance heaters or gas boilers, and I'm going to say... Wait, can you repeat the question? Hold on, just want to make sure I have it right.
Sure.
Say it again.
Sure. According to the IEA, the U.S. in 2022, residential heat pumps made up 53% of heating system sales, exceeding the sales of what for the first time?
Gas boilers?
Close. Gas furnaces. We'll give it to you.
Gas furnaces.
Okay, so you got 3-4. Nice work. And last but not least, we have Julia. Are you ready, Julia?
This is going to be a bloodbath, but yeah, let's just do it. I'm going to blame the baby thing on this one. But yeah, let's try.
You're going to do great. This federal agency released two proposed rules this year that would set more stringent tailpipe emission standards for light-duty and heavy-duty vehicles.
The EPA.
Correct. Which state installed the most utility-scale solar PV capacity in 2023 through September?
I'm also going to go with Texas.
Correct. They installed... over 1,600 megawatts, followed closely by Florida and then California. This federal program, created by the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and administered by the Federal Highway Administration, is working with all states to deploy fast chargers along more than 79,000 miles of highway and roads.
Oof, the name of the program? What is answering machines? I don't have that one.
Close. The National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program, or NEVI.
Ooh. Oh, NEVI. Yes, NEVI. I knew that.
Yes.
Not the acronym.
That's all right. And last, this state became the latest state to take regulatory action to accelerate EV adoption by adopting California's Advanced Clean Cars 2 regulation, joining 11 other states that have adopted it.
I'm going to kick myself. I'll guess Maryland.
Close. Delaware. Yes.
Right.
Great. Okay. Well, 2-4. And so the winner of our rapid fire 2023 trivia quiz is the one and only Stephen Lacey.
Yay. Bit of a sour victory. I'm kind of bummed that I didn't get that million EVs number. I literally just did a show on electric vehicles and I had that number in my head, but hey, Great game, everybody.
Hey, yeah. Good, great job, everybody. And, you know, I had the easy role in this. I got to do all the research and pull these together. If I were on the other end of this, I think I probably would have struggled. So so kudos to you all. And
you asked me what keeps me up at night. It was actually this game last night.
Well, I didn't want to make you too nervous, but I think, you know, this could be a good rematch in a future time. So in the meantime, I'll look forward to putting my voice on your answering machine, Stephen.
Let's talk. I love it.
Great. All right, guys. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. We had more questions than we had time to answer, but really appreciate everyone taking the time. And Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody's work here and insights. Just a great conversation.
Absolutely. Julia, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. It was a real pleasure to dust off the brain and get back into it.
And Dr. McCoy, thank you so much for all you're doing and for being on the show today.
Yeah, fantastic to be in this place with you all. And I applaud all the work that you're doing and getting the word out and all those things. So thank you so much.
All right. Electrify This is an Energy Innovation original podcast. Energy Innovation is a nonpartisan energy policy firm delivering high-quality research and analysis to help policymakers and regulators pursue a decarbonized energy future. You can find more information about Energy Innovation and the podcast at energyinnovation.org/electrifythis, or you can now send us an email at electrifythis@energyinnovation.org. And please do consider taking our brief survey to give us your input. We really want to hear from you. The link in the show notes will have the link to the survey. It'll also be on the website, and that is, once again, energyinnovation.org/electrifythis. And of course, please continue to tell your friends and family, give us a review if you like what you're hearing, and help us spread the word. Real big thanks for all the work our sound engineer Rowan Stigner does for us here at the Audio Inn in Salt Lake City. And I hope you all have a fabulous, safe, and relaxing rest of 2023 and a great start to 2024. We'll be back in the new year with new episodes and a new season, so keep tuning in. Thanks again. I'm your host, Sarah Baldwin, and you're plugged in to Electrify This.